Storylines New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
When the village first attracted summer residents, mountain views were everywhere. The Ossipee Range and the Belknaps could be seen from nearly every point as one strolled across open fields or drove over curvy, hilly dirt roads.
Go into one of the two small public libraries in the central New Hampshire town of Gilmanton, and you'll most likely find the book Gilmanton Summers, Memories of a New Hampshire Village in the Early 1900s. The modest 100-page volume includes vintage photographs, personal recollections, and colorful commentary on the small farming town where author Jane Scriven Cummings spent her life. Bill Donahue, Cummings' grandson, is a freelance writer now living in Oregon who spent parts of 40 summers at his grandmother's Gilmanton home.
It's a sort of casual history where she talks about the various people she knew and what the town was like in the early 1900s. She was connected to a Gilmanton that sort of went by the wayside eventually. You know, it was a very pastoral farming community. And there was all these stories connected with that. And she was sort of the last link to those stories. And I think that she wrote the book to basically set those stories down and not have them forgotten.
Bill Donahue's grandmother wrote her book, with his mother Barbara's help, in 1993 and produced about 500 copies. Old-timers bought them, local libraries keep them on the shelves, and the Historical Society still holds on to a few copies. The book connects readers to a Gilmanton that longtime residents are anxious to preserve, partly because of a yearning for times past, and partly because it's a kind of antidote to another book about Gilmanton, a notorious work of fiction called Peyton Place. In 1956, when Peyton Place exploded onto the American scene, Grace Metalius's novel instantly transformed Gilmanton from a serene New England hamlet into a national spectacle. The dark secrets and chattering skeletons in the closets of Metalius's Gilmanton attracted curious hordes from across the country, and the book's incredible success put the town in an unwelcome spotlight.
Even today, after almost 50 years, Gilmanton's longtime residents are reluctant to talk about Peyton Place. Many are still angry about it, and the town has refused to capitalize on its notoriety in any way. Coming up this hour on Storylines New England, we look at the impact of Peyton Place on the world of literature, on the idyllic New England image, and on our assumptions about life in small-town America. Once again, writer Bill Donahue.
I asked the librarian which book was more popular, my grandmother's or Peyton Place, and she was sort of aghast that I would even ask such a question. She just said, "Your grandmother's book, of course." And what I take away from that is that the writer Tobias Wolff once said, every organization has an official history and an unofficial history. And writers always want to tell the unofficial history. I think that my grandmother, her impulses I don't think were so much literary as they were booster. And that's what people love. Grace Metalius told the unofficial history. And they don't really want to hear Grace Metalius's version. And it is just a take. I don't think that the town ever was as grim as she depicted, but it certainly is a part of the story.
From the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Storylines New England. I'm Kevin Gardner.
And I'm Laura Canoy. Storylines is a special 13-part radio project of the American Library Association that looks at the literature of New England as a way to better understand who we are as New Englanders and Americans. We've turned to Robert Frost to explore New England's landscape, looked at our region's political influence through Mark Twain's A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, and examined the decline and revival of our small towns in Edith Wharton's Summer. This week on Storylines, we turn again to small-town life, this time to its inner workings and to the scandal, town gossip, and social hierarchies revealed in the pages of Grace Metalius's 1956 blockbuster, Peyton Place.
Before Peyton Place, the mythology of small-town New England life was described in the tales of Sarah Orne Jewett, enacted in Thornton Wilder's Our Town, and pictured in the paintings of Norman Rockwell. This mythology spoke of orderly village greens, pristine white churches, and well-kept yet modest homes. Its men were hard-working, sober, callous-handed Yankees. Its women, apple-cheeked, practical, and virtuous. It was a place where traditional values reigned, where neighbors looked out for each other, where the simple beauty of the landscape seemed, through its cycle of seasons, to harmonize with the lives and characters of its inhabitants. Not surprisingly, the first few paragraphs of Grace Metalius' masterpiece play on these assumptions and on the images that go with them.
One year, early in October, Indian Summer came to a town called Peyton Place. Like a laughing, lovely woman, Indian Summer came and spread herself over the countryside and made everything hurtfully beautiful to the eye. The sky was low, of a solidly unbroken blue. The maples and oaks and ashes, all dark red and brown and yellow, preened themselves in the unseasonably hot light under the Indian summer sun. The conifers stood like disapproving old men on all the hills around Peyton Place and gave off a greenish-yellow light. On the roads and sidewalks of the town there were fallen leaves which made such a gay crackling when stepped upon and sent up such a sweet scent when crushed that it was only the very old who walked over them and thought of death and decay. The town lay still in the Indian summer sun. On Elm Street, the main thoroughfare, nothing moved. The shopkeepers, who had rolled protective canvas awnings down over their front windows, took the lack of trade philosophically and retired to the back rooms of their stores, where they alternately dozed, glanced at the Peyton Place Times, and listened to the broadcast of a baseball game.
But as the pages turn, Peyton Place becomes another New England altogether. Metalius, it was said, unbuttoned the region's small-town life to reveal its dark, never-before-seen underside. In Peyton Place, every school, general store, and quiet home seemed to harbor stories of lust, vice, and incest, with seemingly peaceful nights full of drunkenness, violence, even rape and murder after the sidewalks were rolled up. Metalius' stories captivated a nation and indelibly transformed the way we look at small-town American life. As the author herself told one reporter, if you go beneath that postcard picture, it's like turning over a rock with your foot. All kinds of strange things crawl out.
Without a word, he carried her out of the car, and she could not utter a sound. He carried her into the living room where the light still blazed in front of the open, uncurtained windows, and dropped her onto the chintz-covered couch. The lights, she gasped, finally. Turn off the lights. When the room was dark, he came to her. Which room is yours? He asked coldly. The one at the end of the hall, she said through her chattering teeth. But it doesn't matter, because you'll never see the inside of it. Get out of my house. Get away from me. He carried her, struggling, up the dark stairway, and when he reached the second floor, he kicked open the door of her room with his foot. I'll have you arrested, she stammered. I'll have you arrested and put in jail for breaking and entering and rape. He stood her on the floor beside the bed and slapped her, a stunning blow across the mouth with the back of his hand. Don't open your mouth again, he said quietly. Just keep your mouth shut. He bent over her and ripped the still wet bathing suit from her body, and in the dark she heard the sound of his zipper opening as he took off his trunks. Now, he said. Now. It was like a nightmare, from which she could not wake until, at last, when the blackness at her window began to thin to pale gray, she felt the first red gush of shamed pleasure that lifted her, lifted her, lifted her, and then dropped her down into unconsciousness.
Peyton Place transformed the literary world as well. In its time, it was banned, burned, labeled as smut, and publicly reviled. In fact, in the upscale town of Beverly Farms, Massachusetts, there was a sign posted on the front lawn of the town library that read, "This library does not carry Peyton Place. If you want it, go to Salem." Yet, in spite of its lowbrow status, it sold. And it sold well. It was said that in thousands of homes across the country, a copy of Peyton Place was hidden behind the furniture or under the bed. Readers from Missoula, Montana to Arkadelphia, Arkansas read the book in the dead of night and recognized the scenes and characters of Peyton Place in their own towns. The name itself became a code for secrets, sex, and scandal in small-town life.
Today on Storylines New England, we look at the influence of Grace Metalius' Peyton Place, as well as the workings of small-town America, and we want to hear from you, your stories of small-town life. Who controls the gossip in your town? Where does the town talk take place? The dump, the general store, at the kids' soccer games? And what happens when a rumor turns into scandal? Join us. The number here on Storylines New England, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477.
We also want to hear your stories of the book, Peyton Place. When did you first read it? How did it open your eyes? Did you hide it under your bed? Did the stories of Peyton Place ring true in your town? Again, our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477.
Joining us now in the studio is Stuart Wallace, a professor of history at the New Hampshire Technical Institute in Concord, New Hampshire. Hi, Stu. Good to see you.
Oh, great to be here.
Also joining us from her home in Maine is Artis Cameron, a professor of American and New England Studies at the University of Southern Maine. Artis is now working on a book called Tales of Peyton Place, the biography of a big book. And Artis Cameron, nice to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for the invitation.
And Artis, I'm going to start with you. The word blockbuster is probably overused in our culture these days, but I think with Peyton Place, it really applies. Give us a sense, Artis, of just how big Peyton Place was when it came out in 1956.
Yeah, Peyton Place actually is the first book when they used the term blockbuster. That really brought that word into the popular culture. At the time Peyton Place was published, most novels sold about 3,000 copies. Peyton Place sold, within the first 6 weeks, I think, something like 60,000 copies. And then it just took off. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for about 56 weeks. It sold eventually within a number of years, a few years, 12 million copies. So it became the number one best-selling novel at the time. It came out in 1956 and 57. Much more popular than Gone with the Wind, sold many more copies than any book until The Godfather. But The Godfather comes out in the 60s, I think 65, 66, with a very different distribution, you know, system. We're talking about 1956, and so blockbuster is the word to describe Peyton Place, absolutely.
And Artis, I want your take on this question and yours too, Stu Wallace. Artis, first, what would you say the impact of this book was on America in the mid-50s, Artis?
Well, it was phenomenal. It's one of the things I'm tracking now in this new book, interviewing different readers and looking at that very question. But really, one of the arguments is that 1956-57, this book was really the beginnings of the feminist movement, the really beginnings of what we call now the sexual revolution. Many people identify the sexual revolution with the development of the pill in 1963 and other aspects. But really, we can really look at Peyton Place as the beginning of the sexual revolution. Until that moment, these issues were not discussed publicly. They didn't call it the silent generation for nothing. So the subjects covered in Peyton Place, abortion, incest, female sexual aggression, these were issues that nobody talked about except perhaps the Kinsey Report. And that was seen as a scientific journal. Even homosexuality is part of the landscape in Peyton Place.
What would you say the impact was, Stu Wallace?
Well, it certainly shattered a certain myth that most people realized needed shattering anyway. It was not only an openness to talk about sex and all these things that didn't appear on Ozzie and Harriet and Life of Father, and people knew that wasn't true anyway, but it certainly, in the end, attacked the sort of the ongoing myth of the New England town, which has come out in a variety of ways. As the intro said, it's Thornton Wilder, it's Sarah Orne Jewett, it's Norman Rockwell, and people had always realized that that is just a myth. It's part true, part false. There's a piece that's missing. And what this did was provided the piece that was missing. Many disapproved. Only a long time ago in Historical New Hampshire, I ran an article on Grace Metalius, and I had a very proper New Englander come up and say to me, "This is horrible that you'd write an article about Grace Metalius." And I said, "Well, what's wrong with it?" And said, "Well, in our day, we knew how to pull the blinds. She opened the blinds, and in so doing, was opened about things that people knew about but didn't really feel like talking about."
She went too far in this person's
in this person's estimate, and in many persons' estimate, she went too far. And yet the people who say she went too far, at the most, when it becomes critical, would say, "Well, it was a bit too dark of a picture. We're not all like that." But the fact is that nobody would ever deny that these things existed in their town. They always had. We just didn't talk about them.
No, instead it was more appropriate to delegitimize the source of what was coming out in the book. Artis, do you think that the impact of Peyton Place on New England had any kind of unique characteristics as opposed to its impact on the rest of the country?
Well, yeah, it was unique. I mean, it did as you mentioned in the above, Grace herself really tried to tweak the tourist image of New England. And I think you have to remember, too, that really with the 1930s and then progressing in the 1950s, there was this whole invented New England that mm-hmm. was part of the Tourist Bureau campaign.
Sure.
You know, Maine put it on its license plates in the 30s, vacation land, and the lobster industry was trying to promote Maine in terms of lobsters in the New England area in a number of visual ways. So she was very clearly trying to tweak that, but she was doing it as a French Canadian. I think that's important to keep in mind, because when we talk about New England, what she was talking about was really some of the problems of an Anglo-defined New England that didn't understand or really appreciate or talk very much about class differences and ethnic differences.
Yes, and as a French Canadian married to a Greek.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Artist, what's so New England about this book, aside from its setting?
Well, what's so New England about it?
Well, could it have taken place in some other kind of town? Couldn't we have ripped the lid off?
Grace always argued that this was not about Gilmanton at all.
Mm-hmm.
She really saw this as much more of a thinking about a small American town that could be anywhere, despite its many unique elements to New England. But in terms of the tradition of New England literature, I think it really is nicely situated in the tradition of a kind of Gothic New England literature. And you talked about Summer. Edith Wharton's work was very much consciously attempting to do the same thing, to disrupt a lot of the regionalist writers who had, sort of like Sarah Orne Jewett, created a kind of folksy, quaint, old salt image of New England in decline. Edith Wharton was very much opposed to that vision. She looked very much at the dark underside of New England culture. Then you have Grace Metalius, and you have others in between there. But then you also have Carolyn Chute picking up some of that, and also Stephen King. He read Grace Metalius when he was a child, and he always credited her with her wonderful descriptions of small-town life.
Yeah, yeah. Stuart Wallace, how true to life is what goes on in this book?
Well,
how true to New England life?
Oh, it's interesting because, it isn't about Gilmanton. I mean, if you really wanted to place it on the map, it's probably West Lebanon because it's across from White River. But she very clearly doesn't define really a place or a time. Even though she's writing, I mean, her main character, Allison, is her age, growing up in the 30s, 40s. You really can't tell that from the book. I mean, there's vague references at the end of the book to World War II. It could be any time, any place. And she consciously avoids being very specific about it. When she was asked the question once in a television interview, the people of Gilmanton seemed to think this is about her. She laughed. She said, well, you know, I always say if the shoe fits, put it on. but she also said she'd written most of the book before she got to Gilmanton.
That's interesting.
Yeah. That is interesting because later on in the program, we're going to hear from some folks from Gilmanton, and they certainly feel that Peyton Place was written about them, and they don't like it a bit.
Yeah, she was living in a town next door. It was just a few blocks, you know, a few minutes away. I can't remember the name of the town, but she was really close to Gilmanton. In fact, she was in Gilmanton much of the time with her friend, Laurie Wilkins, and she would read Peyton Place out loud at the farmhouse that Laurie Wilkins was called Shaky Acres a little bit later.
Right.
It's up on the hill over by the kennel there. And so people in town knew her. In fact, Laurie was a reporter for the Franconia paper, and she interviewed Grace. And that's when she began to write in the local paper about Grace Metalius writing this novel about Gilmanton and the area. And that's when people really got nervous.
This is Storylines New England. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Kevin Gardner. And today on Storylines, we're looking at the hidden machinery of small-town life, the social hierarchies, the skeletons rattling in closets, through Grace Metalius as Peyton Place, the 1956 blockbuster that shouted the secrets of, perhaps, a real New Hampshire town. Join us 1-800-892-6477. That's the number here on Storylines New England, 1-800-892-6477. With us in the studio, Stuart Wallace, professor of history at New Hampshire Technical Institute, and joining us from her home in Maine, artist Cameron, professor of American and New England Studies at the University of Southern Maine. Again, our number here on Storylines New England, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And I want to get into one of the major themes that I saw in this book, Artist Cameron, that surprised me. You know, when I picked up Peyton Place, I thought, okay, this is going to be, you know, sex on every other page. But there's actually a lot more to it than that. And one of the interesting things to me, artist, was the social hierarchy in Peyton Place. Give us a sense of that hierarchy from the book. And then, Stu, I want to ask you, you know, how realistic that was 50 or 60 years ago. Artist?
Yeah, sure. I think it's interesting when you read the book today, the issues of sexuality do seem kind of tepid at this point. But at that time, they were really sensational. But in terms of the class issues and the class hierarchies, they were very representative of local towns in the 1950s and even going back to the 30s and 40s. The sort of face-to-face relationships begin to break down in the 1960s and 70s. But in the book, I think she does a masterful job of giving you a sense of how the town professionals, for example, this kind of professional class that forms a kind of sort of leadership. And then you have the mill owner, you know, Leslie Harrington. And the mill owner in many towns was a very formative figure. Even in Gilmanton, the Packard woolen mills were just down in Ashland, and you had some of that tension there as well. So I think she does a great job, you know, thinking about those hierarchies and those structures. And then you had the shack people. You had some of the sort of middling farmers, sort of substantive farming families. And then you had the outsiders, kind of the tourists, and small shopkeepers. Allison's mother is really fascinating for that, in terms of, you know, maintaining a female-headed household on the one hand, but also being an independent shop owner, which is something that was very much a part of the New England scene until recently with the Walmart, you know, movement.
You know, you mentioned the social hierarchy, artists, and the social hierarchy, the shack people and so forth. We have a reading now from Peyton Place that talks about how the town fathers, the big guys in town, feel about Lucas Cross, one mm-hmm. of the shack people, and in general, all the people that lived in the shacks just outside of downtown.
Lucas Cross had lived in Peyton Place all his life, as had his father and grandfather before him. Lucas did not know where his ancestors had come from originally, and this fact did not bother him at all, for he never thought of it. If he had been asked, he would have been dumbfounded by the stupidity of such a question, and shrugging, would have replied, "We always lived right around here." In northern New England, Lucas was referred to as a woodsman, but had he lived in another section of America, he might have been called an Okie or a hillbilly or poor white trash. He was one of a vast brotherhood who worked at no particular trade, propagated many children with a slatternly wife, and installed his oversized family in a variety of tumble-down, lean-to makeshift dwellings. He drank, beat his wife, and abused his children, and he had one virtue which he believed outweighed all his faults. He paid his bills. To be in debt was the one and only cardinal sin to men like Lucas Cross, and it was behind this fact that the small-town northern New Englander, of more settled ways and habits, hid when confronted with the reality of the shack dwellers in his vicinity.
Stuart Wallace, this description of a relationship between two different economic and social groups has been called, I think, actually artists just called it a masterful job of description. How do you feel about how that relates to what you see in the small towns of New England now? Has that kind of relationship changed? Has it altered in any way?
No, to some degree it's still there, because what this book did was that it got to the people they call them shack dwellers or shack people. It got to this Michael Harrington would have said the other America. It got to these people who live out of sight, and it gets into their homes. This book actually spends more time inside the home of Lucas Cross than it does inside of the home of the mill owner Leslie Harrington. And that's interesting, because that paves the way, I think, for the first time, it paves the way for subsequent writers like Thomas Williams at UNH or Ernest Hebert, who've really gotten into this other side of New England, which is there. It's always been there. It just isn't very visible. It's not, you know, you're not going to be on the tourist trails. You're not going to be pictured in the tourist literature, but it's the level of poverty that's still very much there today. And in most towns, you can just go a mile or two outside of town and still find genuine poverty in trailer homes and even cellar dwellings still existing in New Hampshire today.
I certainly remember so-called shack dwellers and their children being in school in my own town when I was young, and I know that there are plenty of towns in New Hampshire. You don't have to go very far to see that this is still true. But let's take a phone call. We have lots of people who want to talk to us about Peyton Place. Nancy is joining us from Auburn, New Hampshire. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I had recently moved back, 1988, to New Hampshire from what would be considered the South, at least in New Hampshire, which is anything south in New York. And I had an incident where I had a riding accident very soon after I moved here and broke my back. No one would talk to us. No one would help us. No one acknowledged that we existed because we were outsiders. I had a wedding and went to a local town to get some veiling material. Woman said, "Oh, you look like you need to sit down." I sat down because my back was hurting. And she said, "What happened?" And I told her. And she said, "Oh, you're the girl who fell off Carol Peterson's horse."
Oh, so Nancy, everybody knew about it. The gossip had gotten out. Isn't that interesting? Uh-huh. And we see that in Peyton Place, too, artist Cameron, don't we, that everybody talks?
Yeah, Peyton Place itself is one of the main characters in the book. And you can see all through that book these wonderful descriptions of people looking, you know, surveillance, watching. There's watchers, there's lookers, there's all sorts of surveillance and voyeurism going on there. And so you do get a wonderful sense of how these towns all are watching, looking, and regulating what's happening. I think today, though, a lot of the gossip that happens is more about, at least in the small town I live in, it's more social entertainment than social regulation, as it was in the 1950s when it operated in a really different manner.
Could you elaborate on that, artist, please?
Well, remember the 1950s, if a young girl, for instance, got pregnant in high school, this is one of the things. Sometimes she would disappear, and suddenly she'd be gone. And people, you know, just knew that something had happened, but no one would talk about it. That wouldn't really happen today. But what you did see is kind of the sense that this was a shameful thing. And so local gossip would spread the word. People would talk about it, you know, behind people's backs. But it wasn't out in the open at all. And there was a lot of ways in which local gossip regulated behavior, and you can see that in Peyton Place. Allison's terrified of people talking. So is Constance, her mother, terrified of talk. What will happen to her and her daughter if, in fact, they find out that she is a bastard, that Allison is out of wedlock and illegitimate child? So all these fears and secrets, these kinds of open secrets, if you will, emerge in the 1950s and, you know, are smashed in some ways by the conversation that goes on in Peyton Place.
Coming up after a break, more on gossip, scandal, small-town hierarchies through the pages of Grace Metalis' Peyton Place. And we'll take your calls at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477.
For more information on Storylines New England or the books that we're reading, visit our website, storyline.ala.org, or check out your local public library. Libraries have copies of the books, program schedules, and our discussion guides. I'm Kevin Gardner.
And I'm Laura Kanoy. You're listening to Storylines New England.
Storylines New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Thank you.
From the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Storylines New England. I'm Laura Kanoy.
And I'm Kevin Gardner. Each week on Storylines, we look at a particular New England author's work as a way to try and better understand ourselves as New Englanders, where we've been, where we are, and where we're heading. Today we look at Peyton Place by Grace Metalius, and at the impact of gossip, scandal, class conflict, and social hierarchies in our small towns. Peyton Place hit the bookshelves in 1956, and many say it completely transformed our ideas of small-town New England life. Stories of innocence, reverence, and goodwill among neighbors were replaced with revelations of scandal, murder, and rape, all taking place along the tree-lined streets of fictional Peyton Place, New Hampshire.
A big part of the story centers on the trial of Selina Cross, a girl from the wrong side of the tracks who was abused and raped by her stepfather, Lucas, until the day she kills him and buries him in the sheep pen. Selina Cross's murder trial becomes more than just a hot topic of town talk, but a national media sensation. Reporters flock in from everywhere, not only to cover the trial, but to find out more about the people they see as backwards, rural, small-towners living in Peyton Place. Here's a scene from the trial, read by actor Pat Tierney.
Peyton Place was overcrowded during the weeks preceding and during the trial. Newspaper reporters walked streets where only Seth Buswell had walked as a newspaperman before, and the summer people, who usually bypassed Peyton Place in favor of the better-known, more highly advertised sections of the state, came to town in streams of expensive cars, all bearing out-of-state license plates. The day after Selina was arrested, the Daily Record bloomed with a headline of three-inch letters, "Patricide in Peyton Place." These words were hastily picked up and flung across front pages by other newspapers throughout northern New England, so that by the time 3 days were gone, they had appeared and been read by practically everyone in four states. Editors dispatched their best reporters to cover the trial of Selina Cross, and Peyton Place took on the aspects of a large, open-air lunatic asylum. Every morning these people flowed into Peyton Place, and every evening they left, but they wrought havoc during the hours in between. For the first time since anyone could remember, the old men who peopled the benches in front of the courthouse were forced to flee and scatter against the onslaught of photographers and reporters who insisted on taking pictures of these picturesque old characters and on buttonholing them with questions which always began with, "What do you think about all this?"
Grace Metalius's depiction of her fictional New Hampshire town's sudden celebrity became eerily clairvoyant after her book was released. It didn't take long before many of Peyton Place's revelations were discovered to have been based on actual events in Metalius's own town of Gilmanton in central New Hampshire. Gilmanton quickly became a circus of media, readers, and fans, all hoping to catch a glimpse of the real Allison Mackenzie or the real house in which Selina Cross had murdered her stepfather. Despite all the attention, Gilmanton didn't really change much. In fact, the town hasn't changed too much in the last 50 years. In spite of a few more houses, a few more stores and restaurants, life is still relatively tranquil and slow. Yet Grace Metalius and Peyton Place still find their way into the gossip around town.
The principal divorced him, and she married a DJ.
My name is Bill. That's what I said. I'm 75 years old, and I've lived in Gilmanton approximately 50 years.
My name is Kelly. I've lived in Gilmanton, 1945.
My name is Connie, and I've lived here around 50 years.
Take us back to Gilmanton 45 years ago. What were the people like back then?
Very nice. Very sociable. They would invite you over to play cards and dinner, and they would give you presents and that stuff when it was your birthday.
That's the best time of my life. We always went with a lot of neighbors. We'd go see them Christmas, all the parades, yeah. It was nice. You don't see that no more.
How did, Bill, the 1956 publication of Peyton Place change Gilmanton?
Well, I think Grace is an icon here to begin with, and I really don't think anybody knew what she was doing. Saturday, if we were going down to church or something, she was usually on the corner, a man's white shirt, dungarees. We'd give her a ride to the Rod and Gun of the Legion. But I don't think people realized that she was writing a book. And once that was written, boy, she was the devil's advocate, my God, because she hit home on a lot of spots. She shouldn't have known all the stuff she knew, but she did her homework.
What was it like that first day when that book came out and people in Gilmanton said, oh my gosh, it's us?
What was December 7th like?
Pearl Harbor Day you're talking about, uh-huh.
Traumatic. Nobody could believe it, and those that knew it were true didn't want to believe it. And those that didn't know nothing about it, they loved it. It was reincarnation of Gilmanton Corners and Ironworks.
My wife, she loved to read. She went and ran and got one of them books in a hurry.
Did she like the book? I mean, she read
it. Yeah? I don't remember. You just wouldn't have stolen it. You hear somebody yakking about it. And I went, well, she was talking about me. And then another one said, well, they went, no, that was talking about Joe and Frank and Henry and all.
People started looking for themselves in the book.
Yeah.
Did you look for yourself?
Yeah.
She turned Gilmanton around, I'll tell you, for a short period of time. But they got adjusted.
Is it true that some people in Gilmanton still don't even want to talk about Grace Metellius at all, don't even want to mention her name?
I do think so, because they don't like what she wrote, and it comes back to haunt them all the time. That's why they don't like to talk about it.
The sense that I'm getting from you is that Grace Metellius, while she wrote the truth, maybe went a little too far in telling the truth. And although gossip is a part of small-town life, it's a part of life everywhere, people feel like she went too far. Where do you draw the line between talk and, well, public expose, like what Grace Metellius did?
I really don't know how to answer that one. You've got to really watch out what you say and be careful. You don't get sued.
That's what I was going to say. People didn't have the money then to sue.
It was a fiction book. Can't sue for make-believe.
Probably every town is the same way.
And I don't think there's any limitations in a book like that. She did her homework. She got the facts. Not all, but she didn't condemn or pick out one individual. No, I think she did a hell of a job. In a book like that, where would you have drawn a line? It was fictional, supposedly, but very factual in a lot of instances. No, I don't think there should be a limit on a book like that.
I think, let's see, isn't there a little freedom of speech? That way you can say anything you want. Just be careful.
Connie, Bill, and Charlie, three longtime Gilmanton, New Hampshire residents, and their recollections of the book that made their town famous, Peyton Place. Today on Storylines New England, we're reading from Grace Metellius' Peyton Place and talking about its influence on the world of literature and on the way we view small-town life. Do you remember when you first read Peyton Place? Did you have to do it in secret? How did it shape your idea of rural America? Did you see a part of Peyton Place in your small town? Call us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. We also want to hear stories of your small town. Who runs the talk and gossip where you live? Does your town have some sort of a social hierarchy? And has your small town ever been subjected to national attention, like Peyton Place was, due to scandal or murder? How did your town handle it? Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477.
And we're talking with Stuart Wallace, a professor of history at the New Hampshire Technical Institute here in Concord, and from her home in Maine, Artis Cameron, professor of American and New England Studies at the University of Southern Maine, and she is working on a book, Tales of Peyton Place, the biography of a big book. Stuart Wallace, we've just heard a little bit of what Artis Cameron earlier characterized as gossip for social entertainment purposes, and she drew a very interesting distinction between that kind of gossip and the kind that we see in Peyton Place, the book, which is gossip, for purposes of social regulation.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about what has happened to the great art of gossip in small-town New England today.
Well, when you first read the book, you're a little alarmed at the gossip, and you say, well, this is too bad that these people are talking about each other. Then you realize that this is part of the social regulation of the community. This is the way that this community relates to itself. It's the way that people relate to one another.
Mm-hmm.
And there's almost a comforting side of that, in that we don't have that as much anymore. For instance, you take the trial of Selina Cross. The only thing that came out of that trial that people didn't realize was that Lucas Cross had raped his stepdaughter. They knew everything else rotten about the guy. They knew that he was a drunk who beat his wife. They knew that he was all these horrible things. And in a way, that was their way of regulating Lucas, except that things got out of hand. Today, all too often in communities, even small communities, we don't know about the Lucas Crosses unless, lo and behold, they're caught doing something heinous and then we see their mugshot in the 6 o'clock news. Mm-hmm. And people, their neighbors are interviewed saying, gee, I don't know, he seemed like a nice guy when he walked his dog. This community, with all of its gossip, knew what everybody else was doing, and it was a form of self-regulation. Today, we go home in isolation. We look at our TV sets, we play with our computers and our computer games, and we have a tendency not to know what anybody else is doing. We have lost what Lou Felsang has called social capital, and we need to develop that again. Maybe we need to bring gossip back, not so much as a form of entertainment, but as a way of getting neighbor to know about neighbor and as a way of redeveloping some of the community ties that we don't have anymore.
Stu, do you think that some of this change is due to the physical way that we live in our small towns now? I mean, in Peyton Place, everyone sits out in front of the store. The old men who are passing gossip back and forth, the town fathers, the people who run everything, have their weekly poker game at which they exchange information. Do those kinds of things, have they disappeared from some of our small-town life now?
We've lost some of the central points of communities. For instance, the store used to be the place where you bought gas, whether it was a soda fountain, whether it was a post office. We've lost most of the dumps now. People call them transfer stations. We've lost, and for the stores, we have the big box stores now. We are, in a sense, being invaded by America, and the franchise America gives us less ability to talk to one another. And we've developed our towns differently. We've built cul-de-sacs and developments, housing developments off in the middle of nowhere, which takes away the centrality of village life.
Go ahead, Artis.
I think there's a danger here, though, too, of romanticizing gossip. I'm going to take Alex's, position here, because when gossip was operating in Peyton Place, for example, and in many small towns in New England, it was regulating certain norms and certain values, but they weren't necessarily the kinds of norms and values that you might want to have regulated, for example. Remember that Lucas Cross, he was regulated some way in terms of gossip about drinking, but Metallus is very clear here. Lucas Cross, the doc, knows this is happening. Everybody in town knows this is happening to his daughter, and no one's doing anything. They might be talking about it. They might be whispering about it, but nobody is going into that shack and making sure that this rape, this incest ends. And so I think it's important. She was very caustic about the gossip. She was really not looking at this as a sentimental, nostalgic, loss.
Although
she was looking at it as a failure in social service agencies, a failure of the government and the towns to really look at these issues and try to do something about them, whether the shack dwellers or these other kinds of child sexual abuse.
And in the case of Norman Page, gossip, the fear of gossip, what people will say, entices him and his mother to make up this huge story about, how he was this war hero when he really wasn't.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I want to bolster what Stu is saying. I think some of these places are disappearing. You hear about general stores closing all over New England. On the other hand, Stu, just to make you feel a little bit better, I had lunch at the bagel shop downtown Concord, which is sort of the social epicenter sometimes, and I always see at least 5 people I know there. Five, 6 people. How are you doing?
People,
so it's still there.
Those contact points, as sometimes they refer to, are really important, very critical. But I think there is a tendency to look at some of this work, of the old, ye old New England village life and the town gossip and things like that as something that was really beneficial for all people. It was beneficial for some people, but not for everybody.
It's funny you say that, Artis. I always say, when people ever talk about the good old days, I say, good for whom?
Yeah,
so,
I know.
Let's
and
go to the phones, folks.
The elephant in the room in Gilmanton is the actual 1947 murder of that particular person, Sylvester Roberts.
Mm-hmm.
And
that was the real murder that happened.
A true story in Gilmanton Ironworks. And we'll use the pseudonym, Jane Glenn, to protect the young girl who was tried and who was sent to prison for 5 years for killing her incestuous father. But that was an issue that people in town didn't want to talk about then. In fact, the New Hampshire state legislature, 2 weeks after the murder of this and the confession of the daughter, and it was quite sensational, as you can imagine, 1947, the confession of this crime and discussion of incest in town, the New Hampshire State Commission, like many states in the Union, created a commission to look into sexual abuse and look into sexual crimes. But they actually relegated incest to a misdemeanor. They saw it as not actually, they couldn't believe it.
We need to take some calls, artists.
Yeah. Not the father.
I want to go to the phones because we got so many people
Sure.
who want to talk to you. Let's go next to Milton, Vermont, and Mary joins us on the air from Milton. Go ahead, Mary.
Yes, thank you. okay, I've lived in Milton for about 40 years, and I was one of the 12 teachers in Milton High School all those years ago when we were tiny. And I first came across Peyton Place because I confiscated a copy of it from a girl who was reading it during chemistry class. And I took it home, and of course I read it. And I was pretty shocked to see right in four letters the F word spelled out. Up to that point, it was always F blank blank K. You knew what it said, but they didn't say it. So shortly thereafter, wife of my husband's department head at UVM offered to lend me a copy of Peyton Place, which a friend had lent her wrapped in a plain brown wrapper. And I said, thank you, I have one. I don't remember. But you're saying, I've been listening, about good for whom. When I first lived in Milton, population about 700, it's now about 10,000, I could walk everywhere I needed to go, the church where I worshiped, the school I taught in, my doctor, the town office, an IGA store who delivered, and now everything's miles and miles away. It's just so different.
Mary,
but even then, I mean, I could see all these characters, the town idiots, town drunks, all these people. So it was very true to life, and I just couldn't resist calling in. Thank you for taking your time for me.
Mary, thanks for that call.
Thanks, Mary. Mary makes the point of familiarity between what she sees around her and her small-town artists and what she sees in Peyton Place. But I wanted to ask you, Mary's experience with Peyton Place clearly happened some time ago, but what's the difference between reading the book in 1956 and reading it today? What has changed in the way that we look at the book, in the way that we construct our reactions to what we see on those pages, artists?
Well, I think Laura hit the nail on the head earlier when she was saying how when you're reading the book today, the issues of sexuality really don't seem as explosive today, given what's gone on in the past 20 or 30 years in literature and television.
I've got to jump in because you're saying something that's tremendously interesting to me. You know, in addition to the freedom of female sexuality that's on display in Peyton Place, there's also a kind of cliched version of sexual relations that's very much of its time, that's kind of combined with this new sense of female liberation, too. Would you care to comment on that?
Are you referring, what in particular are you referring to?
How about the sort of female hysteria of Constance's resistance to Tom?
Yeah, frigidity.
Yeah.
Yeah, the discourse is, particularly after World War II, women were, you know, either whores, they were asexual, or they were hysteric. There's this whole discourse in the 1950s, sort of post-war period, about female frigidity and claims to female frigidity. So Grace Metalius was working, you know, around that with her character Constance. Grace was very influenced by Freudian discussions, as so many young, educated people were in the 1950s. And so she was using some of that to try to, again, think about people like Norman Page, Constance McKenzie, and all the different varieties of sexuality, female and male.
Right.
A reporter once asked her if she ever thought there was any kind of sex act that was a problem. She said, far worse than any sex act is unattractive food, and I'm no gourmet.
Isn't that right?
You know, she was very bawdy, and she saw this issue of sexuality as something that was part of life. She couldn't understand why people were upset about it.
Stuart Wallace, We've talked previously about how Peyton Place shattered a certain idyllic New England image. The white church steeples, the town greens, right. That sort of thing, by allegedly going underneath it, burrowing down into the dark underbelly. But we can't help but notice that New England is still selling that image and doing very well by it.
They will continue to sell it, and we will always sell the rural image of New England, even though, say, a state like New Hampshire has traditionally been fairly industrial and urban over time. And Grace herself is interesting because she doesn't come from this postcard, this sort of false Anglo WASP postcard image of New England. She herself is French, married a Greek who was an atheist. She didn't go to the parochial school, went to the public schools, rejected to a large degree her own Franco culture. And yet she never really does fit in anywhere. She doesn't right. fit into where she came from. She doesn't fit into Gilmanton. And as a result, she sort of stands aside as one who's looking at it and then say, I can observe this objectively from Rhodes End or wherever she had Allison observing it from.
She certainly is a kind of classic dissenting outsider. We have an awful lot of people who want to talk to us about Peyton Place. Let's take another call. This is Donna. She's calling from Westminster, Vermont. Hi, Donna. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I just have an anecdote. I grew up in a small town in Massachusetts, Harvard, Massachusetts. And when I was 12 years old, we had a guidance counselor, George Metallius. And he had either just recently divorced from Grace, or I don't think they were still married, but we were very aware of Grace's book being published. And I remember there were a few copies of Peyton Place that got circulated amongst the 12-year-old girls and kept under our pillows in our bedrooms that our mothers never found. And I just wanted to
You're
share...
You're not alone.
I just wanted to share that little anecdote. I just sort of thought it was kind of funny that George was our guidance counselor.
You know, Donna, thank you so much for that call. Artists, that's classic, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
Peyton Place
yes.
under the pillow where mommy can't find it.
Yeah, yeah, in all sorts of places. Or in bookshelves where kids can't find it. You know, parents who were reading it, and John Waters, the film director, he would at 10 years old go into his grandfather's house and he'd climb up on the shelves and pull out Peyton Place and read it for a couple of hours.
What are your memories, Stu, of when Peyton Place came out? And you know,
well, I hate to date myself by saying I remember it
very
well.
You were telling us before the show, yeah.
No, I remember it very well when it came out. It was one of those books you weren't supposed to be caught seeing, and the joke was that you could take any one of, especially the hardbound books, and hold it by the spine down, and it would fall open to one of those juicy sexual parts. Actually, by today's standard, it's pretty mild, and the sex part has been overplayed. The part about alcoholism and spousal abuse and child abuse is far more shocking today than the fact that two people are making love.
Let's go back to the phones to Manchester, New Hampshire, and Bob is on the air. Go ahead, Bob. Thanks for calling Storylines New England.
Hi, it's Bob Perot. I've been spending the last 20 years trying to get people to look at Grace as a serious writer. I give tours of her Manchester neighborhood, lecture for her on the Humanities Council.
Did she live in Manchester too, Bob?
She was
yes.
born in Manchester.
Oh,
and
I
she
see.
She spent the first 18 or so years of her life in Manchester. And people don't know that. Everyone thinks she's from Gilmanton. And I've just been trying to educate people about the serious side of Grace, that she was a good writer. And when you look at her descriptions of the New England landscape, her descriptions of people and the psychology of people in small towns, there's some really beautiful writing in there. And I really get upset when people just talk about the gossip and the sensationalism and all that, because you're right, if you read her today in the context of today's time, it would be, there would not be that sensationalism. I think you could concentrate on the the better side of her writing.
Right, Bob, yeah.
Bob,
yeah.
You bring up a really great point. Artis, I'm going to ask you to comment on this because, of course, since this book came out, it has been misrepresented grotesquely, not only by the sensationalism that accompanied it, but also by some really, I can't think of a bad enough adjective to describe the way that the television series and the two movies that have been made of this book have distorted what's actually in it as a piece of literature.
Right.
So the question is it possible now to reconsider Peyton Place as a work of literature and to leave it at that?
Well, one, yes, it needs to be reconsidered. That's one of the reasons why I think in 1996 I contacted Northeastern University Press and asked them to reprint this. It had been out of print for almost 20 years, more than 20 years. And I, like Bob, I read this book. I thought, this is a terrific book. It's really very interesting. So it is being reconsidered. It's part of what my project is about, to kind of rethink this. And when it came out in 1956, remember, Carlos Baker from Princeton gave it an excellent review in the New York Times Book Review. He compared the writing to John O'Hara and Sinclair Lewis. So it's terrific praise for much of the book. You're right about the film and the TV series. The TV series has nothing to do with the book or with the film. That came out in 1964,
right.
But that was watched by 60 million people 3 times a week.
Wow, it's amazing.
And it's actually the TV show that propels Peyton Place, I think, in many ways into popular culture, to being thought about as a kind of suburban sex, drugs, and rock and roll book, you know, and it kind of elides the really interesting book that was in 1956. And I think Bob's absolutely right about that.
Yeah.
Stu Wallace, one last quick question for you. Could another book today have the impact that Peyton Place did in its time, given our current culture where anything goes?
No. I honestly don't think it could. I think that this came out of the blue. You could see it building up. I mean, you mentioned Sinclair Lewis and others, but this book, because of its origins, because of how it came out from this sort of unlettered, fairly unschooled person, it's so genuine. And I would agree with Bob Peralta that there's more to it than just the sensation, that she actually did craft a very interesting piece of work, and I don't see another one having the same impact.
Well, Stu Wallace, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Stuart Wallace, he is a professor of history at New Hampshire Technical Institute in Concord. And Artis Cameron, thank you also.
Thank you.
Artis Cameron, professor of American and New England Studies at the University of Southern Maine.
For more information about Storylines New England or the books in our series, visit our website at storylines.ala.org or visit your local public library. Many libraries in your area will have copies of the books, program schedules, tapes of our past shows, and even discussion guides.
Storylines New England is produced by Keith Shields. Our engineer is Andrew Walsh. We had production help from Dan Colgan, Garen Daly, and Rebecca Kaufman. Chauncey Kerr and Pat Tierney performed our readings. Our library discussion guides were written by Bill Ott. Georgia Lomax coordinates the participating libraries.
The executive producer of Storylines America is Paul Zalis. Excuse me. Storylines New England comes to you from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio in Concord, New Hampshire. I'm Kevin Gardner.
And excuse me, Kevin, I do apologize. I'm Laura Kanoy. Join us next week for Storylines New England.
Storylines New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Next time on Storylines New England, our connection to our land and to our neighborhoods through the pages of Annie Prue's Heart Songs and Other Stories.
Prue's collection of yarns paints a picture of a rural blue-collar Vermont trying to hold on to its identity as towns grow and gentrify and outsiders threaten to bulldoze the cultural landscape.
Maintaining our sense of place and Annie Prue's Heart Songs and Other Stories on the next Storylines New England.